From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Big Sandy, a great singer who writes and performs rockabilly, western swing, and honky-tonk music. Also, why stress can leave us more vulnerable to illness. We talk with Dr. Esther Sternberg of the National Institutes of Health. She's researching how stress affects the communications between the brain, the endocrine system, and the immune system. Her new book is called The Balance Within. The cast recording of the 1954 revival of the Three Penny Opera has been reissued. Lloyd Schwartz has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Florida Supreme Court refused today to throw out thousands of challenged absentee ballots in two Florida counties. The justices voted 6-0 to uphold the rulings of two lower court judges who said the ballots were valid, even though county election officials had allowed Republican Party workers to make changes to the absentee ballot applications. The 25,000 ballots in question came from Seminole and Martin counties. If they'd been thrown out, Vice President Al Gore could have overtaken George W. Bush in the state's vote count. A state Supreme Court spokesman said that although the court doesn't condone irregularities in the two counties, it affirmed a lower court finding that there was no evidence of fraud, gross negligence, or deliberate wrongdoing. Lawmakers in the Florida State House have named a slate of Republican electors loyal to George W. Bush. The issue now goes to the state Senate. NPR's Melissa Block reports.
The House vote comes after hours of impassioned debate filled with references to scripture and the struggle for civil rights. Republicans, who outnumber Democrats in the House 77-43, said it was their constitutional duty to choose their own so-called bulletproof slate of electors and thereby guarantee that Florida's 25 electoral votes will be counted. "We have a charge to keep," said GOP Representative Jefferson Miller, quoting 1 Corinthians, "those who have been given a trust must prove faithful." Democrats beseech the Republicans to reconsider. Representative Arthenia Joyner urged her colleagues to forge their way into the deep waters of conscience. Democrat Ken Gottlieb said the legislative action, quote, "smacks of old-style party boss politics." Gottlieb went on, "the only thing that's missing is the smoke-filled room." Melissa Block, NPR News, Tallahassee.
Police in Spain have arrested Russia media owner Vladimir Guzinski. A judge ordered that Guzinski be held in jail near Madrid while authorities decide whether to extradite him to Russia. NPR's Michelle Kellerman has reaction from Moscow.
Russian prosecutors say they're already translating important documents into Spanish to make their case that Guzinski should be sent back to Russia to face fraud charges. They issued an international arrest warrant after Guzinski failed to show up for questioning last month. Guzinski's lawyers are vowing to fight the extradition. His supporters argue that the Spanish police were tricked into getting involved in a purely political case. Guzinski is a high-profile media magnate with holdings that include the independent NTV television station, often critical of the Kremlin. The media tycoon was jailed for 3 days in Russia in June, but was released. He's been abroad since, mainly in Gibraltar, Israel, and at his villa in southern Spain, where he was arrested. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Moscow.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials gained 42 points to close at 10,768 in light trading. This is NPR News. The family of an actor who was shot and killed by a Los Angeles police officer has filed a claim against the city for $100 million. The claim is the first step toward a lawsuit. More from NPR's Ina Jaffe.
Attorney Johnny Cochran is representing the family of actor Anthony Duane Lee, who was shot and killed while attending a Halloween party at a swanky Bel Air mansion. Officer Teriel Hopper and his partner had gone to the house to investigate a noise complaint. Hopper was looking into the window at the back of the house when, according to the officer, Lee pointed a replica model handgun at him. The officer believed the gun was real and fired 9 shots through the glass. Hopper's claim of self-defense has been questioned, however, since a county coroner's report showed that Lee was shot 3 times in the back and once in the back of the head. The 39-year-old actor had some small roles in movies and appeared on TV shows including ER and NYPD Blue. Attorney Johnny Cochran says he hopes the claim will force the police department to improve their training and policies for dealing with noise complaints. Ina Jaffe, NPR News, Los Angeles.
People in the Midwest are digging out from a record snowfall. The snow kept children out of school and many workers home from their jobs in more than 10 states. County officials in parts of Michigan declared states of emergency and closed their roads so that snowplows could start clearing away more than a foot of snow. National Guard soldiers used Humvee vehicles to rescue motorists stranded when the snowdrifts closed highways in northern Indiana. Cold weather closed in after the storm, icing power lines and trees. In Ohio, winds gusted to 80 miles an hour, knocking out power lines and leaving more than 300,000 homes and businesses without power. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing NovaSoy brand isoflavones to consumers throughout the United States, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Big Sandy, is a great singer who writes and performs rockabilly, western swing, and honky-tonk music. Jeffrey Himes of The Washington Post wrote that Big Sandy's songs aren't pale imitations of the classics. His tunes are good enough that the next generation of hillbilly revivalists will end up emulating him. Big Sandy is the nickname of Robert Williams, who grew up in Orange County, California, and is now in his mid-30s. He started his band, the Flyright Boys, in 1988. They have several CDs. The latest is called Night Tide, and it has a sadder, lonelier sound than their previous recordings. Let's start with Big Sandy's song, When Sleep Won't Come. It's inspired by Spade Cooley, the Western swing bandleader of the 40s, who was imprisoned for killing his wife.
4 drinks into 5 o'clock, I'm wide awake, wondering how much more of this that I can take. I wish I knew what to do when sleep won't come. Heaven knows I loved her more than I can tell. Now the memories haunt me in this lonely cell. I wish I knew what to do when sleep won't come. Every night I lay me down and try to close my eyes. I can see her face and hear her cries. Well, maybe if I could be king again for just a day, I could close my eyes and drift away.
That's Big Sandy from his new CD called Night Tide. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Hi, how you doing there?
The song that we just heard is based on the life of the bandleader Spade Cooley, who killed his wife while his daughter watched and then was, of course, put in prison. So this is, I guess, inspired by his story of being sleepless and in prison, haunted by what he'd done. What made you think about writing a song about him?
Well, at that time, I had a friend of mine who was doing time in prison, a guy I had grown up with and who just kind of went down the wrong path, you know, had begun a downward spiral with drugs and just kind of it escalated and kind of, well, he ended up being locked up. And I had that on my mind, and I was kind of thinking, what might it be like for a person, anybody, like, doing time and to be alone with their thoughts and their conscience. And recently read an article about Spade Cooley, and I thought maybe I'd write a song from his perspective, you know, just alone with, like I said, alone with his thoughts at night. And he's somebody whose music really moves me, and I thought it's such a tragic story, you know. I know. I guess that's what was going through my mind. Yeah.
Has your friend in prison heard the song, and does he know that he's part of the inspiration for it?
No, he never got to know that. Actually, he passed away. It's quite a tragic tale there in itself. Like, he actually tried to escape, and led the police on a chase, and ended up putting a gun to his own head before they caught up with him.
Wow. Did you think that the escape itself was a form of suicide attempt?
It's hard to it's hard to say. They're still investigating this situation.
Right.
It may not have played out the way it was reported.
I see.
But it's something we're not sure about yet. But
right.
Anyway, so those sort of things were on my mind at that time.
I think that your band, Big Sandy and his Fly Right Boys, started kind of as a rockabilly band. Then you got more into country western music. And there's a lot of more just country-oriented music on the new CD. Can you talk a little bit about the change of directions you've taken as a performer?
Yeah. Well, this band started out in 1988, and we were pretty much just a straight-ahead rockabilly band. And I was we all were in a few different rockabilly bands in the L.A. area before the Big Sandy thing began. But I'd always listened to country music, western swing, honky-tonk, as well as, you know, rhythm and blues, R&B, and doo-wop. But when we began, I sort of was, I didn't want to let any of that influence my music. I was, you know, seems silly now looking back, you know. As time has gone on, I've kind of dropped my guard and let all these other styles like fall into the music. It's stuff that I've always listened to at home, but for whatever reason, I'm not sure now looking back, but I didn't want it to be mixed in with what we were doing at the time, you know.
Your birth name is Robert Williams, but you perform under the name of Big Sandy. Is Big Sandy a persona or just a nickname?
Well, I guess it's become a persona. It's something I slip into before I go on stage. When I began singing, I started to realize that I could become somebody else, be somebody that I'm not really in everyday life. I can be kind of quiet and shy, I guess, during the day, but when I step on stage, I really kind of shift into this other personality, and I guess that's become Big Sandy.
Well, let's pause for another song from your new CD. And this is a Roger Miller song called A Man Like Me. Now, I grew up with a couple of songs by Roger Miller that I really didn't like, King of the Road and Dang Me. And I've heard a lot of songwriters over the years speak with awe about Roger Miller and his songs. I've really never understood it because I know King of the Road and Dang Me. This song helps me understand why songwriters admire him so much. Tell me why you chose to include this song on your new CD.
Well, as the songs were coming together for this album, there seemed to be a little bit of a theme developing, a theme of like sort of darkness or loneliness. And the Roger Miller song, A Man Like Me, had already become like a band favorite. It was something we listened to a lot on the bus. And, you know, I like to spend time before a trip, you know, making up tapes for the road. And that was something, a song that everybody seemed to get into. And stylistically, it's a sort of area, territory that I kind of want to move more into, doing some more of the country shuffles, like late 50s and early 60s sort of thing. I know what you're saying about Roger Miller. You know, a lot of people know him for his wacky sort of novelty things. But he when he wrote a serious song, it was a serious song, and there's the human side of Roger Miller is pretty amazing, or at least what he shows in a lot of his music, you know.
Well, let's hear it. This is A Man Like Me from Big Sandy's new CD, Night Tide.
Myself believe that it's for good she's gone. Why must I go through this pain? Day and night, it's all the same. Heaven help a man like me who walks alone. Honky-tonks have no.
That's the Roger Miller song, A Man Like Me, from the new Big Sandy CD, Night Tide. I have to say, I really love your singing, and I think that song is a good example of why. Now, I know that you listened to a lot of music in your parents' record collections when you were growing up. What kind of music was in your mother's and father's collections?
Well, my mother had and still has a lot of 45s, mainly doo-wop and R&B. She just really loves the especially the L.A. groups. She really goes for the L.A. vocal group sound. And my father, on the other hand, had a lot of country, rockabilly, western swing records, 45s and 78s. And him and I used to spend a lot of time on the weekends going around town looking for records at thrift stores and junk shops. And I was just surrounded by all kinds of records growing up. And the other kids would, you know, maybe be out, you know, playing football or tossing the ball around with their pop. You know, me and my dad were that's what we did together. You know, I look forward to every weekend. You know, and we still do it from time to time. You know, and sometimes I, you know, as often as I can. You know, we're on the road quite a bit, but you know, when I'm back in town, I'll go and visit him, and that we still will sit around and talk about records, and he'll show me some of his latest finds. You know, we still have that bond. That was a thing I shared with my father, but also with my mother. Like, there was a time earlier in their marriage when my father would kind of be away a lot, and I wasn't sure where he was, you know. I thought he was working, but he'd be gone for a few days at a time, you know. He just kind of would go off on these drinking binges. But during that time, I just had, like, really vivid memories of my mother sitting at home, you know, waiting for him to come back, you know, listening to her like, doo-wop records, you know, and it was before any of the other kids came, but, like, that was just something special that her and I shared. I mean, even without even talking about it, it was kind of like we had little moments, you know.
So the music helped connect you to your mother?
Yeah, I think so, you know. Yeah, she still gets out those old records now. We kind of reminisce together, I guess, you know.
My guest is Big Sandy. His new CD is called Night Tide. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest, Big Sandy, writes and sings rockabilly, western swing, and honky-tonk music. His new CD is called Night Tide. Well, you have a CD that you did a couple of years ago called Dedicated to You that's an album of mostly doo-wop songs.
Yeah. That album was mainly for my mother, you know. I'm not sure why, but I guess I was afraid to really attempt any of the doo-wop and R&B material. It's just something I held in such high regard. I didn't think I would be able to touch it, you know, vocally anyway, you know. But I'm glad that the guys at High Tone Records, you know, convinced me that it'd be a good idea. And I guess in the back of my mind, it's something that I wanted to do for a long time, but I needed a little push, you know.
Well, there's a song that you do in here, I'm Leaving It All Up to You, that was a hit by Don and Dewey. And you actually recorded it with Dewey Terry from the original Don and Dewey. How did you get him to record this with you?
Well, I first met Dewey in 91 over in England. We were doing a rock and roll festival together. And he went out of his way to I mean, he was such a cool guy to me, you know. I was just, like, in awe of him, you know. And I told him how much his music meant to me, and I told him, you know, I would, you know, rattle off songs like, you know, this 45, and I like the flip side of this one. And we became friends, and we kept in touch, and, you know, we've done shows, a few shows together over the years, and I've gone to see him perform when he's been doing little lounge acts or, you know, playing in the little bars around L.A. And when we started putting together the concept for the Dedicated to You album, his was a name that came up, that popped up in my mind right away. You know?
Well, why don't we hear the duet that you did with him? Do you want to say anything about it before we play it?
Just that it was just so amazing, like, standing next to him in the studio, singing alongside of him. It was quite an experience. I mean, really beyond words.
Okay, well, this is from Big Sandy's CD, Dedicated to You, and this is Big Sandy with Dewey Terry of Don and Dewey.
I'm leaving it all up to you. You decide what you're gonna do. Now, do you want my love?
That's music from Big Sandy's CD dedicated to you. He has a new CD, which is called Night Tide. We talked a little bit about your parents and music. Your grandfather on your mother's side was in a mariachi band. What did he play, and what did he wear when he played?
Well, he wore the traditional, you know, outfits that they wear. What do they call those? I don't know. But I never knew my grandfather, you know. I only know stories, you know, from that my grandmother used to tell when she was around, you know. And I've seen a couple of old pictures, and, you know, he played guitar, and I guess, you know, he had an old Martin, and my grandmother tells me he has to keep a rattlesnake rattle inside of it for good luck or something. I'm not sure what that's all about, but I wish I knew more about him and about that side of the family, but I just don't. Yeah.
So what's the ethnic mix of your family?
Well, my mother's family's from Mexico, from Durango, Mexico, and they came into the States here through El Paso, and I believe my grandmother moved to California in the 30s. My father's side, he's of like English and Irish descent. Not sure exactly what the background is on that side. I know some of the family was from Oklahoma, but there's another part of his family from Utah, and I'm not sure what the complete story is there.
You know, I'm thinking a lot of kids when they're growing up who they spend their money or some of their money on records, and their parents berate them for it, and sometimes parents even want to throw out record collections. This was particularly true probably a few decades ago, but it must have been nice to have parents who really respected you for wanting to buy records and shared your love of music.
Well, I feel pretty lucky about that. Although it is funny you mentioned about parents making you throw out records. You know, my dad did go through one little phase where he kind of, you know, had somebody had taken him to a Billy Graham crusade, and he came back with this new thing, you know, like we were getting rid of all these evil records in the house, you know. And my mother and I hid some of them. We stashed them away, you know. That was kind of funny. But fortunately, that was a short-lived phase for him, you know.
Did he throw out his own collection?
Yeah, you know, it's pretty sad, you know. But this was like early 70s, you know. But he's amassed quite a few records since then, you know. I mean, so he probably more than he had gotten rid of originally, you know.
What did he do to earn a living? You've managed to earn your living in music. What did your father do?
He's a welder. He still works at the same place that he's worked at. I mean, he's worked at Associated Concrete Products in Santa Ana, California. He's worked there since the early 60s. You know.
Many of the songs on your new CD are originals, songs that you wrote. How did you start writing songs? And I'm wondering if you have certain role models who you've looked to that you've listened to a lot in terms of figuring out what makes a good song.
Well, I'm still trying to figure out what makes a good song. But just as I've learned or am learning to sing from listening to old records, I have sort of figured out what the basic framework for these types of musics are, like provided, I guess, like a sort of foundation for me. You know, I can listen to a Lefty Frizzell song and there's the structure right there. I say, well, that's what a country song should be, just using that as an example. But as time has gone by, like I want to bring more of my own, more of myself to the music. I know guys like Dave Alvin have been a big influence on me, like just in the fact like somebody like Dave, like who is deeply moved and influenced by older forms of music, but has not let the framework of these older styles like confine him. He's used that as a starting point and has like branched out with something that is definitely his own, and that's, I think, the challenge that I've set for myself. And I think I'm not quite there yet, but I feel progress there, and I'm happy with the way things are going. But I think I'm just now kind of letting my guard down and allowing myself to be a little more honest with my music rather than just trying to recreate things that have been done before, you know.
Do you have a favorite of your originals on the new CD?
Between Darkness and Dawn is a personal song for me, and that's one I was happy with.
What's personal about it?
Well, I guess I was just sort of reflecting on just sort of a personal struggle, you know, just the basic, I mean, the most basic thing between, like, you know, good and evil, you know, but all of us, the kids in our family, we were raised up going to church and kind of, you know, the whole family did that thing for a while, you know, and even though you fall away from it, you still have some of those beliefs tucked back inside of your mind somewhere. And some of the things that you can get involved with the sort of, you know, life that comes along with being on the road and being in clubs and bars every night just kind of doesn't completely sit right with me somewhere inside, and it's kind of just basically about that struggle, you know.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
And why don't we hear Between Darkness and Dawn from Big Sandy's new CD, Night Tide.
Well, when did I stray from the path to wander in the night? I'm deep within this world of sin, it's so far from the light. Here by the wayside, I feel I can't go on. Lost between darkness and dawn. Well, when did I fall from his hand into this world so strange? Though I try, it seems that I'm too weak to make a change. I'm just a sinner, I sing a sinner's song. Lost between darkness and dawn.
Big Sandy and the Fly Right Boys from the new CD, Night Tide. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And from Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The cast recording of the 1954 revival of the Threepenny Opera has been reissued. Coming up, a review from Lloyd Schwartz. Also, what scientists are learning about the connection between stress and illness. We talk with Dr. Esther Sternberg of the National Institutes of Health. She's also author of the book, The Balance Within. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Many stressed-out people and their doctors have reached the conclusion that stress leaves us more vulnerable to illness. Now scientists are discovering a biological explanation for this phenomenon. My guest, Dr. Esther Sternberg, is one of the researchers studying the connections between the brain, the endocrine system, and the immune system, and how these connections explain the effects of stress on health. She's the author of The Balance Within, The Science Connecting Health and Emotions. She's also a physician trained in rheumatology, and she directs the neural immune program at the National Institutes of Health. She says when you're under stress, hormones are secreted and nerve pathways are activated. Those changes also affect the immune system, making it less able to fight invaders. I asked Dr. Sternberg to explain the body's stress response when adrenaline and other hormones are released.
What's happening when all these events are happening at the same time is that many parts of your body are getting ready, are being readied to fight or flee. And stress, therefore, is a very important part of life. Because when you think of it, if you're an animal in the wild, if you're a field mouse and you arrive in a new field, and a cat comes along, if you're not stressed, if you're just relaxed and you go to sleep, you're going to be eaten. You have to have a certain level of stress response to protect you, to allow you to recognize that there is a threat and help your heart start beating fast so you can pump blood to your muscles so you can get ready to run. And you have to feel and recognize that you're stressed. Otherwise, you're going to just stay in that dangerous place and you won't have any reason to leave.
But over the long period of time, the adrenaline isn't going to be good for you.
Correct. So the problem arises if you're that field mouse and the cat goes away and you're still standing there feeling stressed and you actually freeze because you're feeling stressed or you can't move and your heart continues to beat fast and you continue to pour out all these stress hormones, and that's when you can have effects on the body and physical illness.
What's the relationship of the adrenaline to the physical illness that you might get?
Adrenaline and other nerve chemicals also have effects on immune cells. The body really has many backup systems, which are quite wonderful. Immune organs like the spleen or the thymus have nerves coursing through them so that there are rich networks, lacy networks of nerves in these organs, so that immune cells sit very closely up against the nerves. And when you are stressed, nerve chemicals like adrenaline, adrenaline-like nerve chemicals can pour out can affect how these cells are developing within the immune organs. So in general, stress and stress hormones and different immune and different nerve chemicals turn down the ability of the immune system to fight infectious disease.
How does the brain communicate to the rest of the body that you're stressed out?
The brain sends signals to the rest of the body that you are feeling stressed through hormones and nerve chemicals. So there's a part of the brain called the hypothalamus that when you're feeling stressed, when you're exposed to some stressful event, or even if you remember a stressful event, that part of the brain turns on and starts pouring out a hormone called CRH. It's short for corticotropin-releasing hormone. And that hormone goes into the bloodstream and makes the pituitary gland, which sits underneath the brain, pour out another hormone, ACTH. And that hormone goes into the bloodstream and makes your adrenal glands that sit down on top of your kidneys like little hats, they start pouring out cortisol. Now, anybody who's used cortisone cream on a poison ivy rash, if you've had allergic rhinitis or asthma and inhaled cortisone spray, you know that cortisone is the most potent anti-inflammatory drug that our bodies make. And I say drug because it was first discovered in the context of a drug. But it turns out it's the brain's way of tuning down the immune system. The brain has to have a way to tell the immune system to shut off when the inflammation is no longer needed. And it happens through this system of hormones, this cascade of hormones.
But does the cortisol do anything to help us cope with the stress?
Oh, yes. Yes. Cortisol turns off the stress response. So when your brain starts pouring out the hormone CRH, and that makes your pituitary gland make ACTH and your adrenal glands make cortisol, cortisol goes back up through the bloodstream and shuts off that loop. So under normal circumstances, it doesn't go out of control. If you wouldn't have cortisol, your stress hormone response would just spiral out of control. So you've got to have cortisol. But cortisol at the same time also shuts down the immune response. And in some cases, that's good. But if it's an inappropriate situation, that's bad.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Esther Sternberg, and she's the author of the book The Balance Within, The Science Connecting Health and Emotions. She's a scientist at the National Institute of Health. Well, now that scientists can really study the biology of stress and its effect on the immune system, what do scientists know about what you can do to counteract those effects and boost the immune system when you need to? Or to diminish the impact of stress?
Well, there's many parts to that question. Just as there are many different ways that the stress system can affect the immune system at many different levels, as I described in immune organs or through the bloodstream, through different nerve chemicals, through nerves, through hormones, you can imagine that we can begin to attack the system in different ways depending upon the problem in a given individual. But you can also think of it in a more global way. That is, if perceiving that something is stressful is causing all these cascade of hormones to have a negative effect on the immune system, then perhaps the most efficient way to deal with it is rather than at the end point, you know, figuring out what kind of drugs we can give to interfere with the effects of those stress hormones on immune cells, which is one approach. We can also go to the other end and say, well, what can we do that can change our ability or that can change our perception of an event as stressful, or at least that can help us to respond with less of an outpouring of these stress hormones than we might otherwise do. And that end of things, that approach to the problem, is really summarized in many of the approaches of alternative, what we call complementary and alternative medicine. And I think that the many different ways that people have evolved over the centuries and through different cultures that different individuals find useful tell us something about the many different ways that we can learn to change our perception of an event as stressful, learn to perhaps disconnect a little bit of that response to the outside world and maybe tone it down so we don't have quite such an outpouring of hormones. I'm not saying that it's totally possible to do that, but I think what understanding this science is helping us scientists and physicians do is understand the extent to which we are able, either consciously or unconsciously, or to actively learn how much we can change our stress responsiveness so that we can not have quite such a deleterious effect of stress on the immune system.
So practically speaking, we might be talking about, for instance, meditation.
Yes. Practically speaking, we're talking about things like meditation. We're talking about even psychotherapy. And in the book, I speculate and that perhaps one of the common features of many of these kinds of approaches is learning, really learning. In the chapter that I've titled, Can Believing Make You Well?, it's an exploration of whether we can really relearn how to perceive an event as stressful or less stressful or more stressful. And what the scientific evidence is that suggests that there is some degree that we can change our responses to these kinds of events.
My guest is Dr. Esther Sternberg, author of The Balance Within, The Science Connecting Health and Emotions. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dr. Esther Sternberg. She directs the Neural Immune Program at the National Institutes of Health. Her new book is about the biological connection between stress and illness. I asked her if some people are genetically predisposed to stress.
That's a very good question, and I can answer it best based on animal studies. So there's no question that there are strains of rats, there are strains of mice also, that that have genetically have a very high stress response or a very low stress response. And in fact, those are the rat strains that I work with. And one of those strains, the low stress responsive strain, when placed in a novel environment, which is a universal stressor, novelty, newness, turns on your stress response. So if you take those low stress rats and put them in a new cage, they're perfectly happy. They explore, they look around, they don't act stressed at all. If you take their high stress cousins and put them in a new cage, they freeze. They turn. They stay in one place in the middle of the cage, and they start running around and chasing their tail, which is a behavior of rats that are stressed out. And if you measure their stress hormones, the high stress rats will have high stress hormones, and the low stress rats will have low stress hormones. So, and these are strains of rats that were bred to be genetically unique and different from each other. And so there's clearly a genetic component to your stress responsiveness. And I think if you think of people, of all the people you know, some people are just more twitchy, they're more anxious, they're more responsive to the same event that somebody else will be relaxed about.
Now, in the case of the rats, you can't accuse them of being more stressed out because they're over-intellectualizing.
Well, what I like to say is that no amount of psychotherapy is going to make the high stress
exactly
rats
right
relaxed.
Exactly. So sometimes it goes beyond that. It's just something
yes.
that's wired into you.
It's wired in. So in these particular rats, they're extremes. They're truly extremes. Although there are probably events in early development, environmental events, all kinds of events that can modulate their stress responsiveness to a certain degree, depending upon how tightly your stress response is set, how finely tuned it is, you may or may not be able to intervene with things like meditation or psychotherapy.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Esther Sternberg, and she's the author of the new book, The Balance Within, The Science Connecting Health and Emotions. She's a scientist at the National Institute of Health. You know how mothers always warn their kids, don't go out in the rain, don't go out in the cold with your without a scarf. Maybe they should really be warning, don't be stressed.
Well, no. Actually, I'm a mother, so I can relate to this a lot. I mean, I feel like not going out in the cold, eating your vegetables and eating well and sleeping well are all speaking to avoiding physiological stress. Okay, when you think of it, going out in the cold, heat, cold, extremes of cold, are physiological stressors. So we talked about psychological stressors, and all those different categories that you're now talking about are physiological stressors. One interesting thing that is actually very new in this science is that different kinds of stressors, if they're physiological or psychological or immune, activate different brain pathways. And so this is really a very exciting area of research for the future to try to understand whether different kinds of stressful stimuli can have different kinds of effects on the immune system depending upon the patterns of the parts of the brain that they affect.
What do you do when you're under stress, believing as you do that that stress can lead to a weakened immune system?
Well, I also talk about that in the book in a way. Well, I talk about how I started writing the book right after my mother died from breast cancer. And I was really in a period of great stress, upheaval, grief. And as I was writing the book, I found that what I would do is I'd come home from work every day and I had this incredible urge to build a fire, and I would build the fire in the fireplace and sit in front of the fireplace and write the book. And as I was writing some of the chapters on stress and on belief, I suddenly realized, well, I'm doing this. What am I doing to find this place of peace? And what is it about the ritual of building a fire and sitting here listening to music while I'm writing a book that is bringing me to that place of peace? And I think if you can find that in yourself and go to those places in your mind at any time during the day when you need to, that's certainly one way to feel less stressed. I think another point that I make in the book, and that I certainly make when I lecture around the country, is that you don't always want to be getting rid of your stress response. You need that stress response. You don't always want to be meditating. If I were sitting here meditating right now, there'd be dead air time, and you'd be stressed, and I'd be relaxed, and the listeners would be bored. So I need to have a certain level of stress in order to be performing. I talked to a Navy pilot who flies F-14s off of aircraft carriers and asked him, when you're flying, when you're landing these airplanes on these little aircraft carriers or big aircraft carriers in the ocean, are you feeling stressed? And he sent me in response a picture over the internet of him flying this F-14 perpendicular to the ocean, about 80 feet off the ocean and 10 feet off the edge of the aircraft carrier. And there are all these people on the bridge of the aircraft carrier waving their arms. And he said, there's only one person in this picture who's not stressed, and that person is the pilot himself. And the reason is because the pilot is in control. He is not meditating. He's not relaxed. The last thing he wants to be doing is meditating at that moment. But he has learned to control his stress response and make it work for him. So I think the other important thing to remember when you're thinking about stress is you don't want to get rid of it all. You don't want to be relaxed and mellow all the time. You need to, at times, be at your peak and performing and controlling your stress response and letting it work for you.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, it's been a great pleasure.
Dr. Esther Sternberg is the author of The Balance Within, The Science Connecting Health and Emotions. Coming up, the 1954 revival of the Threepenny Opera. Lord Schwartz reviews the cast recording, which has just been reissued. This is Fresh Air. One of the most famous original cast albums is not from a Broadway show, but from an off-Broadway one, the legendary 1954 production of Kurt Weill's Threepenny Opera. It starred his widow, Lottie Lenya, and became the longest-running musical of its time. That album has been reissued on CD. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review.
When I was finally old enough to see Kurt Weill's Threepenny Opera, the off-Broadway production had already been running more than 6 years. None of the original cast members, Lotta Lenya, Joe Sullivan, Bea Arthur, John Astin, Charlotte Ray, was still in the show, but I loved it anyway. And I can't think of a better way to wrap up the Kurt Weill centennial year, the 100th anniversary of his birth, and the 50th anniversary of his death than with the new reissue of the original cast album. The appearance here of Lotta Lenya as Jenny Diver, the role she created in the original Berlin production in 1928, automatically gives this recording major historical significance.
Remember Julius Caesar's fame, recall his destiny. Of all the dogs, top dog was he, but his best friends did him in thoroughly, and all because top dog was he. He screened a root, et tu, ye brute. I hope you've got the moral now, but I'll spell it for you anyhow. His high position put him on the spot. Is it worth it to be top dog? Guess not.
I also love the performance of the Barbara song, sung on this recording by Beatrice Arthur, decades before Maud and Golden Girls. Her expressive baritone is perfect for the role of Lucy Brown, the jailkeeper's daughter who once tried to save herself for the perfect man, but who all too easily loses her upright perpendicularity to the charms of Mac the Knife.
I used to believe in the days I was pure, and I was pure like you used to be. My wonderful someone will come to me someday. And then it will all depend on me. If he's a fine man, if he's a rich man, wears a fine cravat, smokes a cigar, and if he's gallant and treats me like a lady, then I shall tell him sorry. Chin up high, keep your powder dry, don't relax or go too far. Look, the moon is gonna shine till dawn. Keep the little rowboat cruising on and on. You stay perpendicular. Oh, you can't just let a man walk over you. Cold and dignified is what you are. Such a whole lot of things can happen. So firmly say, but sweetly, sorry.
I met B. Arthur once backstage at Boston Symphony Hall, where she was taping a Pops concert. I told her how much I admired this recording, and she was touched that someone remembered it. She said she still considered this production, especially working with Lenya, the best thing she ever did. The most controversial aspect of this three-penny opera was the adaptation by composer Mark Blitstein, who shortened it, simplified Weill's original orchestration, and supplied his own English translation. Many Weill aficionados condemn the way Blitstein cleaned up Bertolt Brecht's nastier lyrics. In fact, those lyrics were expurgated only for the album because someone from the record company showed up at the recording session with a list of objectionable phrases, which Blitstein changed on the spot in order to save the recording. The original Mac the Knife was far more degenerate than in the lyrics we know. Still, no one has yet come up with a more memorable or singable English version. So it's wonderful that the new CD closes with a performance of Mac the Knife with Lotta Lenya exuberantly accompanied by Mark Blitstein from an unknown TV interview show just before the opening and only recently discovered in Lenya's personal archive.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix and teaches creative writing at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From BEA, providing the WebLogic e-business platform, infrastructure software for the development and deployment of e-business applications, BEA.com. And from Random House Incorporated, Bantam Books Division, publisher of Flags of Our Fathers by James Bradley with Ron Powers, a story of the men who raised the flag on Iwo Jima. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, one of the most hotly disputed elections in American history, the presidential election of 1800. The candidates were two framers of the Constitution who had become enemies, Thomas Jefferson and John Adams. We'll talk with historian Bernard Weisberger, author of America Afire. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.